And welcome to 10,000 Posts, the show about how everything is posting. My name is Phoebe. We don't have Hussein today because he is not very well. So you are stuck with me riding solo. This is another installment of our Posters of History series. And we have got two very, very special guests. We have got our Posters of History correspondent, our chief correspondent. We've got Dr. Eleanor Yarniger.
Hello.
And we also have her co-host from the very, very good We're Not So Different podcast. We have Luke Waters as well. Welcome, you guys.
Hey, thanks for having me. Thanks for having us. Yeah.
We're very excited to talk about how Dante is a little bitch because we are both jointly obsessed with Dante. I would say that's accurate, wouldn't you, Luke?
Oh, yeah. I love Dante. I sometimes you can't tell because my delivery on it might be a little flat affect the whole time. I legitimately love Dante. Just incredibly fascinating. And yeah, he is at once, you know, kind of a genius and a giant, giant bitch. Amazing. Yeah.
So if you didn't get that from our little opener there, today we are going to be talking about Dante Alighieri, who was a 13th... Yep. Like, seriously, just for a second, I was like, what? How do the centuries work? Is it backwards or forward?
Just for a second. I do it every time.
Just for a second. Florentine poet, writer, and I guess philosopher. Could we call Dante a philosopher?
Yeah, I think that you kind of have to say that he is, in that I would say that the Divine Comedy in general is an articulated theological philosophy. I would say that.
Okay, yeah. Fine. Yeah, all right. I'll allow that one. Yeah, just in case you were under the impression that I am faintly enumerate. Number one, you are right. He was born in the 13th century, died in the 14th century. So you can call him either. I'm happy with calling him either one.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And he wrote a very, very important giant poem called originally called the Commedia. We know it as the Divine Comedy. But we're not here necessarily just to talk about the Divine Comedy. I mean, we are. Yeah. It's a great big thing. It's very much worth reading. I'm a big fan. Mm. But we're also talking about how Dante was a poster.
Yes.
We are talking about how Dante was a poster. Oh. And one of the aspects of being a poster is you gotta be a little bitch.
Mm-hmm.
You can't be a good poster unless you're a little bitch, I think.
He's just, and this is the thing, is that what he's got that makes him a real poster in that little bitch thing is just the petty is off the charts. Mm-hmm. He's got receipts on everyone who slighted him ever. You know, like it's the equivalent of if he'd posted a selfie and you replied with an inscrutable emoji, he is going to put you in one of the circles of hell his novel. That's just it.
There are people there who are like, you know, villains from history and, you know, people who, you know, are, you know, demons and monsters and everything like that. And then there's like people who are just guys he passed on the street that he didn't like. Like, he didn't know, he didn't have a personal relationship with, he didn't like any of, he's only met them once or twice, and he's like, nope, third circle of hell because you bumped into me one day, and you were having a bad day, and you didn't say sorry or whatever, and now you're in hell for all eternity, because he has portrayed himself as the Chad in heaven, while you have been portrayed as the soy jack in hell for all eternity, literally the most Chad versus soy meme ever. Cause it's like, no one can respond. None of those people can respond. Or if they did, we don't know about it or don't care. And yeah, there he is. Thanks, Dante.
And I think this is a very, very important point, which is something that I wanted to flag up. So I'm really glad you mentioned it, Luke, before I had to, which is this is pre-European printing.
Yes.
I know people like to say, oh, well, there was no printing before 14, whatever. That's simply not true because there was printing in China. There's no printing in Europe up until this point. Mm-hmm. So whoever has some kind of control over publication has an enormous amount of cultural and social power in a way that in a way, which is not, it's not dissipated or democratized by the invention of the printing press, but it is altered. So Dante puts in his poem that you're in hell because he doesn't like you. There's basically nothing that you can do about it unless you have a similar level of, what do we want to call it? Clout?
Yeah. I mean, it is clout. Yeah. It's like, what if you had to have the clout in order to post in the first place?
Yeah.
That's kind of the deal. It's like, you're allowed access to the posting factory via clout. But it's also interesting because he does have all this clout. He's like, I mean, he's giving like names and numbers. It's like, he's essentially being like, this guy's in hell, but he's not dead yet. If you'd like to see him, this piece of shit, while he's still alive, he lives at 243 via Martini. You know, like he's like out here giving identifiable information, which is incredible. Mm-hmm. And what's even better about it, you know, he's doing all this posting. He's just fully reading all of these people for filth. But he's so committed to posting. He's one of the first posters who was so committed to posting that he gets exiled. Like, not from Twitter, you know, not from Insta. He's like, sir, you're going to have to leave Florence. Right.
Yeah.
Like,
Dante is, when we were thinking about when we got this topic, I was like thinking about it, and I was like thinking about how he does come before the advent of, widespread movable type printing in Europe. I think this kind of makes him like almost a proto poster. Like if Martin Luther is the first like true poster, or however we want to say it, you know, he's one of the proto, like they're proto reformists. He's one of the proto posters because he lived in the time where like he could say all this shit, and the only people who could respond were like other writers, other poets, or like, you know, clergy or whatever. And, you know, so he was able to post and not really have people immediately respond to him. Whereas, you know, someone like Luther, while we remember all of Luther's writings as being, he's writing these grand things, but most of them are responses to other people being like, hey, Luther, you're a dumb idiot. And he's like, hey, fuck you, buddy. You know, so you get the actual like back and forth of like the post. But with Dante, he's like, hey, Pope, you're a dead asshole. And the Catholic Church was just kind of like, hey, you know what? This is going to be the unofficial version of hell for us for like 500 years. Are you guys okay with that? Everybody cool? Yeah, great. And everybody in the future is going to associate hell with what Dante wrote here. Mm-hmm. Cool. Let's do it. Yeah, great.
Yeah. Can we do that? Is that? Yeah. No, we can. Oh, no. It turns out we can.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
It turns out there's very, very little recourse about that. I sure do hope no one invents a machine which is going to interfere with that, because that would really put us in a jam, I think.
Yeah.
And it's interesting too, because he's also got like posters armies to a certain extent.
Yes,
because
Boccaccio. Boccaccio was his biggest stan. Fucking loved him. He's the one that called it divine. He's the one that called the comedy divine. Sorry, go ahead.
No, you're so right. So it's like he's got like he has got friends that he can call in. So, you know, it's the equivalent of like if someone says something to me that I do not like on Twitter, I can feed him to the hogs. Mm-hmm. You know? I can simply, you know, like retweet what they've said and be like, lol, and, you know, ruin their life with, you know, whatever. And Dante's got that. But the trouble is he's also IRL. There are other mighty factions that will mean that you are kicked the fuck out of Florence.
I see.
He wins in terms of posting over time. Like, we're talking about posts. And like a lot of the reason we remember any of his enemies is just because Dante immortalized them, right?
The only reason anyone remembers the Guelphs or the Ghibellines outside of specific Italian medievalists is because of Dante. Like, that's it. We don't.
Completely. Like, I mean, even I, as a medievalist, wouldn't have to fucking know about that, really, because I don't trifle with those Italians. You don't know what they're doing down there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they can't be trusted. You don't
know. No. To make fun of Italians.
You don't know you don't know what they're up to.
No.
There's absolutely, they've got their cars with the three wheels. They've got their regionally specific pasta dishes. We don't know what they're up to.
And it's even more sinister because in the 13th and 14th century, they don't even have tomatoes and shit yet. So I'm like, what are you eating with that?
What are you putting on your regionally specific pasta?
Yeah.
All olive oil all the time. I'm like, can we get something else? This is a little heavy, guys. I feel like I ate like 9,000 calories. Like, well, you did. Dante is...
Only 9,000? Are you ill?
Yeah. You gotta have way more than that, buddy. Dante is fun because, like, he was also, like, if he didn't like you, he just didn't like you, like, no matter what. Pope Boniface VIII saved his life, literally saved his life, because he kept him in Rome while Dante was sent there on, like, to parlay with the Pope about, like, Florence and all this stuff. And Boniface VIII kept him there, kept him alive because his enemies, the Black Guelphs, took power in Florence while he was gone. And Boniface was like, no, you need to stay here. They're going to kill you. And then when it came time to write the Inferno, Boniface VIII in hell, motherfucker, get there. He was one of the ones Eleanor was talking about where they were like, he'll be here in a couple years. Don't worry about it.
But yeah, it's incredible because it's like, imagine saving a dude's life and he still goes for it in such a manner. It's like,
he's such a bitch.
He's a true poster. He doesn't have to acknowledge what he owes to other people. So it doesn't matter that Boniface saved his life. Like the fact is he's got something to say. He's got beef to air, and that's going to get aired. Like maybe in private, he's like, you know what? You know, I think you're a good guy. I fuck with you. But I gotta put you in hell. I mean, it was a pretty good object lesson in why you should never ever write about the people that you hate. Because you always do run the risk of making them immortal, which is not something you want to do. Ideally, that's not something you want to do. Now, I want to just talk a little bit about his context, and then I want to come back to some stuff that Luke was saying, because we had some really interesting stuff which I don't want to kind of get missed about who Dante's enemies were, what his position was in Florence. So if you could just tell us a little bit about, first of all, just a little bit of context. Let's get Dante situated. What's going on in Florence around this time?
Okay, so I guess the thing to remember when we say Florence at this time is it's not just the city itself, but it's the area around it. Like this, like Florence is also Pisa at this point. Like, I don't know what to say. You know, like, granted, we're talking about Florence itself. This is where Dante lives and works. They are incredibly wealthy, and they are rich off of banking stuff, like to the point that the florent is kind of like a well-respected form of currency across Europe. And there are two, ostensibly, groups that take varying sides within power in Florence. There's the Guelphs and the Ghibellines. And the Ghibellines are kind of like associated with the Holy Roman Emperor more generally. They're kind of like, oh yeah, the person who should be running everything is secular, and that's who we should side with. The Guelphs, meanwhile, kind of side with the papacy and the papal states. But then within the Guelphs, there's a further split into the Black Guelphs and the White Guelphs. Down on the side of like, well, I didn't mean literally. I just meant that, like, the emperor shouldn't be here. So basically, they're with the White Guelphs, that Dante's a White Guelph. They don't want the papacy really to have any say. In particular, they just don't really want the emperor to have say. Whereas the Black Guelphs are like, woo, Pope. Yes, Pope, Pope, Pope. So that's all going on. And there are varying fights back and forth with this. So when one group has the upper hand, they will usually come down really, really hard on everyone. And at one point in time, especially while Dante was coming up, the Guelphs were in the ascendancy to the point where even like the Black Guelphs had ruled Florence for some time. And at that point in time, Dante was like the equivalent of the mayor, mm-hmm. of Florence, like when the Black Guelphs were ascended. Unfortunately, for him, like he then kicks a bunch of people out that he doesn't like. So, you know, some Black Guelphs as well, but a bunch of White Guelphs, certainly some Ghibellines, and he's like, get the fuck out of here. We're running a safe town now, right? But basically then they end up getting sort of kicked out around in 1301, 1302. And so he's then asked to leave the city. And this is when he kind of goes to Rome, gets held by Boniface VIII. Things of this nature. So he gets kicked out of Florence. And if he wasn't such a poster, he would then have been allowed back in to Florence. Except that like he does this kind of like poster's gambit where, because he's been kicked out, he's like, I don't know, maybe I fucking like the emperor now. what about that? And Henry the VII was kind of like being like, kids, don't make me come down there and knock some sense into you. And Dante was like, when dad gets home, you're in so much trouble. And like writing all of these letters back to Florence, all about how Henry the VII was going to come liberate them all. And he was going to be the boss of Florence again. Instead, Henry the VII just fucking died. He just kicks the bucket in 1313. Hilariously, all the other exiles are then let back into the city, except Dante, because he posted too hard. So, like, everyone was like, well, Henry's dead now, so come on, guys, like come back in. Like, no hard feelings, except for you, Dante. Because it's like, shit. Fuck, shouldn't have kept posting about how much I love Henry VII. Like, it's really good. It's really good.
That is really good. Particularly since part of the issue was that when he was posting too hard, he wasn't thinking smart about it. Because if he had just sort of said, okay, well, nobody who can possibly like retaliate in any kind of meaningful way, because I can publish, I have the power of publication. But he doesn't do that quite. He aims high with his beefing. Well, can I ask you both it's an idiot's question functionally, which is about how medieval Florence functions, which is, so you're Guelphs. Mm-hmm. Love the name, by the way. It's adorable.
Yeah, good, right?
It doesn't it sound like it's like a kind of cute little kind of sort of forest dwelling creature of some description?
Guelphs and Ghibellines sounds like a the names of two little species of woodland sprites in a kid's TV show.
Yeah, like a Ghibelline. Are you joking me? Like I'm supposed to be worried about the Ghibellines when everyone knows that they've got nice sweet faces like hippos. Like, come on. And they're like tiny and they maybe go like or whatever. Like, you know, I think that's just what we just have to be accepting when we're dealing with. So were the Guelphs political parties in the manner in which we would understand it, or are they more factions? Like, how's Florence being run? How's this working in practice?
Great question. I mean, they're kind of like a political faction, only like what if a political faction was also a gang?
Yeah. Okay.
It's kind of the thing. So they're like, we will also knife fight about this.
Like Italian politics now.
Yeah, basically, okay. Basically. So, you know, not much has moved on. I will say that. So like technically they're a republic, and they have a council, which is called a signoria. And the signoria gets voted on like, let's not get too excited. It's a republic. Sure, but it's a republic in the medieval way, in that like basically this gets chosen by a guy called the Gonfaloniere, who's the ruler of the city, and he gets elected every 2 months by various members of the guild in Florence. So it's basically the guilds themselves run things, which is, you know, kind of the dream for most cities at the time. Like, let's not get in the way of this, right? Let's just let the commercial guys run things up in here, right? Mm-hmm. And it is a fairly good way of doing things as far as the rich people are concerned. There are a lot more people than that living in Florence. They've got a population of about 30,000 in the 13th century, which is a lot. Mm-hmm. But it's like the signorias are kind of the ones who have built, basically, if it's not quote unquote Renaissance, everything that you picture when you picture Florence was built by the signorias and stuff like, and especially in the 13th century. So it's like, they're the ones who like made the big piazzas. They build a lot of the palazzi. So this is just kind of like how it goes down. And then, so basically the signoria, like they will have different positions based on whether or not they're Guelphs or Ghibellines. They're aligned with varying noble houses. And then eventually like the Medici will take over, after Dante's time. So this is kind of like pre-Medici, but like deeply into the Republic at this point.
Mm-hmm. So they're voted every 2 months,
mm-hmm.
and that's just right. Okay. That sounds truly hellish. I think we're starting to get a little bit of insight into what Dante's influences and inspiration was, mm-hmm. the idea of having an election every 2 months. But presumably this is not something that just ordinary people could vote in.
No. You've got to be a member of a guild, and you know, membership of guilds is controlled very jealously. And there are kind of the major ways to get into a guild is, one, to be born into a guild. Number two, to apprentice into a guild. And then number three, you can sometimes buy your way in.
Okay.
Like you can just, if you come up with enough money, they'll be like, yeah, sure, you're in. But not everybody can be a member of a guild. So what we always kind of say about guilds is think about them like a union / mafia.
Mm-hmm.
So like you basically have to pay protection money to be a part of it. But then once you're in, they will ensure that you are making a lot of money off of what it is you're doing. But because you're going to make a lot of money off of what it is you're doing, they want to make sure that numbers are kept low. So
are they trade guilds functionally?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, some are trade guilds. Like most of them are trade guilds. And they'll be doing, you know, the making of particularized things. Like Florence is quite famous for its leather goods, for example. You know, there's like cloth makers. So for example, they experience in the 14th century a rather large revolt of like wool merchants and wool workers who are not in the guild, but you know, it's the answer is always wool. It's medieval Europe, wool.
It's always fucking wool.
Yeah,
like even time. Like even towards the end of the late medieval period in England,
yeah.
which is what I know more about, it's still fucking wool.
Henry
the Seventh and his wool.
The way it is wool until
different Henry the Seventh, just to be sorry, just in case anyone
that's true.
Is getting convinced. Different guy, very different vibe.
Really different vibe on him. Yeah, that's
different,
true.
Different vibe. Henry the Seventh. We're doing
like top Trump's Henry the Seventh. Like just yeah.
But still both very much obsessed with wool and the wool trade.
Mm-hmm.
Is Florence fairly unique in this kind of organization, or is it like other medieval city states, or
They are all a little bit different and wilding out slightly. Now, some of the Italian city-states are kind of similar. So like Genoa has a kind of similar system and that kind of thing. But some will have more like actual ruling families. So like you still will have a count or a duke who runs the city itself. And it's less of a republic. But so, for example, this is very similar to what's going on over in Venice. And it's interesting. I think that one of the things that I just always caution people, it's like, do I think this is probably better than a monarchy? Yes. Is it functionally just like a monarchy where guys have an election every 2 months between the rich guys? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, you know, elective election at this point in time doesn't really have anything to do with democracy. So like, let's just, you know, we got to be chill. But yeah, the Italian peninsula is wild. What mm-hmm. can I say?
Okay. Okay, this is really, really important background, I think. But just talking about Dante himself, what kind of level of society? So we know he's a member of a guild. Is he kind of part of an aristocracy, or is he part of a kind of upper middle class? Like how's that functioning?
That's a great question. And I suppose that for the all intents and purposes, like he's a patrician. Mm-hmm. I guess is what you'd say. Like, not like aristocracy, but he's certainly a patrician. Like, the Alieres are somebody, you know, but they are also working for a living mm-hmm. in the way that things are.
Thank you for correcting my butchered pronunciation from earlier, by the way.
He doesn't quite rise to the level of never having to work for anything.
Yeah.
And just living off the family money. But his family did have money and connections such that, you know, he was, he's really wealthy. He just still had to go into the job sometimes, I guess, you know, and if he called his dad, he could stop it all. Like, he's never going to live like common people until he gets exiled. And then he's still not going to because he's friends.
Okay.
Yeah, pretty much.
Okay, I think that's worth knowing. He did say that his own family could trace their descendants back to ancient Rome, which is a very funny thing.
That's so funny, medieval. I love it. Yeah. And it's interesting too because it just shows how he's trying on this kind of noble thing because nobles love to do that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, royals love to do that. They're like, oh, yeah, man, I'm definitely descended from Aeneas. Like, sure you are, babe. Cool.
Totally. Yeah.
You know, like, uh-huh.
Yeah, the Habsburgs all descended from Caesar, too. Yeah, they have a certificate to prove it. They'll show mm-hmm. it to you in Austria. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They'll show it to you in fucking Plano, Texas, where that one is.
Oh, how the mighty have fallen. You used to rule the world, and now you're talking at a strip mall in Texas, you inbred fuck. Sorry.
I'm not sorry.
No, I just mean that I'm sorry that I'm derailing everything. Sorry. I'm not sorry about anything.
You're not derailing. This is beautiful set furniture as far as I'm concerned. And also, I mean, what we have to remember as well is this whole thing of claiming not just kind of ancestry, but kind of ancient ancestry is probably something that he will have got off the Romans in the first place.
You got your
Romans kicking about saying, you know, oh, you know, I'm descended from a god, actually. Yeah? Just a god that, you know, from when the gods used to hang out here and have children with humans. That's me. And then you get Dante, who's just like a bit of kind of watered down version. Well, I can't claim that I'm descended from Venus. That's a bit much, isn't it? But I will say that I am descended from ancient Rome. And he does
Rome,
non-specifically. Rome. And he does come up with in his own, he writes his own autobiographical section in the Commedia. And he does come up with the name of his alleged Roman ancestor. It's pretty much that, Eleanor, as well. It's so close to being like, yeah, like Gaius Cool Gaiacus was my ancestor. And so that sort of comes up. It doesn't really come up in any of his biographies, but it does come up in this little kind of about me section that he puts up front, because this is the thing. That's what I want to talk about. I want to talk about what kind of poster he is, because you could call the Commedia one massive post. You could.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think if I'm going to put him in any category, I'm putting him in the blogosphere. He's a blog guy before the widespread popularization of the comment section.
He's a Starfire guy.
Because I think there's an argument for him being a forum guy. I think there is an argument for that,
mm-hmm.
but he doesn't enjoy the reply in a way that the forum guy.
I think he's
a blog guy because part of being a forum guy, which then is what evolved into being at least one version of the archetypal Twitter guy, is part of it is the response, part of the kind of the heightened, I guess, like battle anxiety, I guess is the best Wait, like, you know, it's like, it's kind of battle joy, but it's also like, but it's also kind of like life ruining permanent agitation. That is absolutely based on the person that you have said something to having something to say back.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So like, if you're a don't at me guy, which is a completely legitimate thing to be, I am a don't at me guy. I think it should be illegal to at me. I think that should be governed by legislation. Yes. That no one should be allowed to at me. I think there should be a specific law about it. But if you are a don't at me guy, then you probably aren't really, really that particular kind of poster, because what you want is the reply. What Martin Luther wanted was the reply.
Yeah. Yes.
Luther was a forum guy because he wanted other people. The people who he is posting about, he wants them to see it, and he wants to know that they've seen it. He wants the recourse. Dante does not want the recourse. Dante wants the opposite of the recourse, which is why I think he is much more of a blogger than a forum guy.
Yeah, I think he's a blogger with a closed comment section. Yeah. He's not even opening it. He does not care.
Nope.
Like, if he wants to hear about it, he and Boccaccio will text or call each other outside of this. He's not going to do that shit. He doesn't care what you have to say. Oh, I don't know that Pope Boniface was in hell. Fuck you. He's in hell. He's in hell. You know what? Now your mom's in hell. Why? I'll figure something out. Like, what are you putting my mom in hell for? I don't know. I got 9 circles right here. I got 9 circles. We can go anywhere from virtuous pagan all the way down to the whore of Babylon. Which one do you want, buddy? Shut the fuck up.
That's what, you keep the more you talk, the lower she gets.
Yep.
The lower she gets. Mm-hmm. Oh, right now I've just got her in with the lustful up the top.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like I could really move her around some. I like the idea that he's got like a kind of mood board in his
yes.
Where he's just like, he's treating it like the sort of polar opposite of the MySpace top 8. So he's
like
8 worst people, but he's just constantly rearranging them. So he has to have them in these kind of like movable, like wooden blocks where he's just, oh, I feel like Celestine was being uncool to me. Maybe I could put him there. Oh, keep talking. There.
His top 8 is all also like Cicero.
Yeah.
And like, you know, he's the ultimate I was born in the wrong generation blogger guy. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And he's like, I kind of actually should have been a virtuous pagan.
You think you're cool because you have a Roman statue, Avi, and you post on Twitter. Like, this is the Rome weeb. He wants Rome. He loves Rome. All of the contradictions that come with it. They killed Christ, but also Caesar was the greatest general who ever lived. And, you know, the Roman Empire was the greatest force for good in history. The one we've got now is a pathetic aftershock of it. But like, you know, he loves Rome, everything about Rome, like, or everything about the old Roman Empire and all this stuff that it spawned. And he, you know, he's going to tell you about it. He should have been born back then. He should have been born at the time of Virgil and Cicero and Homer, so he could hang out with his actual peers.
Yeah.
As he sees it in the poetry world. And I'll be completely honest, you kind of got to give him credit because he really did call that shot. He's easily one of the most known and popular poets to ever live, like leaps and bounds ahead of.
And this is so important as well, because the Commedia is fucking great.
It's so good.
Fucking great piece of work. There is a reason that people still read it now, and it is because it is a work of genius. And I think that having a personality as bad as Dante had, coupled with his extreme innovative genius, I think is a very important aspect, because most posters are not geniuses alongside it. It's quite an unusual thing to be, because being a genius quite often comes alongside with it comes alongside with character traits which you wouldn't associate with being a poster. So like the guy who came up with zero, he's not a poster because he's too busy coming up with zero.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Like Einstein's not a poster. Virgil wasn't a poster.
Isaac Newton wasn't a poster.
Isaac Newton wasn't a poster. Fucking Kepler was a poster.
Oh, Kepler was such a poster. That's such a good call.
Yeah, it is.
Oh my god. Yeah. Oh my god.
We don't want to get too much into Kepler, but just so we're clear, Kepler was an astronomer who wrote a very lengthy defense of his mother, who was accused of witchcraft. And it's cracking. It's cracking stuff. Definitely a poster because it was sort of nominally in defense of his old mum, but it was also absolutely about him. Like every single word of it is about him and how what an incredibly smart guy he is.
Yes.
And he was a smart guy, but he wasn't a sort of Galileo. Galileo wasn't a poster.
No. I think Galileo was a poster. That's why he got in trouble.
Okay. I think he was, but I think he's like a different. We can talk about. You know what? Let's do an episode about Galileo.
Yeah, we could totally do an episode about Galileo. When I was in Florence a bit ago, quite recently, there's in the Galileo Institute there's a reliquary which has like Galileo's finger bones in it, which first of all that is incredibly goth, and second, can you imagine how infuriated the Catholic Church must have been about the idea of there being relics of Galileo, just being like, that is our thing. You can't have that as well. You gotta choose. Like space or relics. Those are your options.
That's such a good troll though, because it's like that is also would fucking piss Neil deGrasse Tyson off no end.
Yeah. Because
he would be like, you have to choose space or relics. And I'm afraid Galileo wants both space and relics.
I think Galileo wanted space and relics.
Yeah.
See, I think the reason that Galileo is to me not a poster is that he obviously felt that his work was sufficiently important that he could put himself at risk in order to disseminate it. And I don't think that is really the poster's spirit. I think he used the mechanisms of posting, but I think his intentions were too noble.
I think he was a real dick.
Oh, he was a dick.
He
was a dick, but he had no. I think he had noble intentions when it came to the space stuff.
Okay, so here's like towards a taxonomy of posters. So, do you need to have noble intentions?
I think you have to have ignoble intentions.
Interesting.
Well, so then Jan Hus was not a poster because he both put himself up for martyrdom and was doing it because of his sincere religious belief.
That's true, but I think that his methodology was sufficiently ignoble that we could still call him a poster.
This is interesting. Okay. No, I love this. Okay.
Yeah, I can see it. Yeah, right? I love Galileo. Interesting as hell.
What a guy.
Yeah, insane guy. I always think he got burned at the stake. He didn't. He just was put under house arrest and died there because nobody liked him. But Yeah, I always get him mixed up with Giordano Bruno. It doesn't matter, but yeah, I always get the two of their deaths mixed up.
Yeah, he's like a real he is an interesting G because it's like he's right, but nobody likes him.
Yeah,
yeah,
and that's like a real it's a real interesting one to go.
Yeah, and
for.
It's different than like being right about religion because you can't really prove that you're right about religion. There's faith in that, but like Galileo could prove that he was right about, and science has since proved him right on a lot. I think most of the things he said, but like, you know, yeah, I agree. Yeah.
I think
we should definitely talk about Galileo sometime. Cause I love talking about him.
Yeah,
we could definitely talk about Galileo. I would just like to gently steer us back
to Dante.
Yes, please do.
Because there is still plenty to say. I think that to be a real, to, to, to really embody the poster spirit, you've got to be like a huge jerk, and the huge and the huge jerkness has to be somewhat separate from whatever it is you do or whatever it is you make. So Dante as a character, I suspect, would still have posted himself into exile, even if he hadn't changed, almost single-handedly changed the course of European literature.
I think we got to
separate those two things out. But it does. But it also is the case that he used said changing the course of European literature in order to advance his posting.
Yeah,
that's so true. Yeah, it's like he invented blogging. It's like if you invented blogging to talk shit.
Yeah.
Like, you know, you aren't someone who's utilizing blogging as an extant form to talk shit. You're like, how do I talk shit? I know.
How do we use technology to my advantage to talk shit where nobody else can respond to me in any way?
Exactly. Yeah.
And that's what I mean about him having the soul of a blogger. But I think that using such an extraordinarily beautiful formal arrangement to talk shit. And functionally inventing that as well. I mean, I know he had, of course, he had his influences in ancient poetry. That's what he wanted to do. He wanted to write an ancient. He wanted to write an ancient epic, and he did run up against some complications because, for example, the Commedia doesn't really have an epic hero, because that's basically impossible to do within a monotheistic world. So even if he has his virtuous pagans, the world of the Commedia is entirely monotheistic.
Yeah.
And part of the struggle of the ancient epic hero is the struggle that plays out amongst the divine. So you're the epic hero, but you have your hero's journey, but it is very, very delimited and controlled by the processes of fate and of kind of divine machination. So you have the favor of one god, but in order for your heroic struggle to have any kind of value and meaning, you have to have pissed off another god. Whereas if you are inhabiting a monotheistic world, then you've got a little bit of trouble, because if you piss off God, then you've pissed off God.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So he can't have an Odysseus. He can't have an Aeneas. He can't have an Achilles. This is not something which is available to him. So he's using some of the forms and some of the energy of ancient literature, but he does invent something new.
He's there, right?
Yeah.
I would argue that he himself, as the character Dante in the comedy, is the chosen one. Hero making the journey. Yeah, because
he's also the narrator. So it's very, very hard. It's very hard to argue that he's an epic hero of the same model. Yeah, yeah. But he's definitely, it's a bit of self insert fic, but he's very keen on self insert fic. I went to when I was in Florence, I went to a church where it's one of the first known images of Dante, and it's this lovely fresco on this church wall, and then he's just like just among all these other people in his hat. He's in profile, so it's very much the kind of the famous extremely kind of strong featured profile of Dante. He's got his kind of famous hat, and it looks like an extremely beautiful Renaissance rendering of a kind of a Where's Wally situation, because you're like, oh, there he is! Hey, I can see him. I can see Dante, and it absolutely looks like he's been interpolated. It's like he's looked at this fresco and gone, you know what would make this fresco absolutely go?
Me.
Can you put me in there? Like, can you put me in there? Maybe next to an angel. I think that would be cute if I was in there next to an angel.
You know,
and,
like, it, it's,
that's what he does.
Like, in a church, it's interesting too, because it's like, you know, one of obviously the entire poem is hyper-religious, blah, blah, blah. You know, we're learning all about the agony and the ecstasy of death and your relationship to God, right? And the Godhead more generally. Brilliant. Great. But like, homeboy's so secular with it. You know, like, part of his beefing with Boniface VIII is that he doesn't like Boniface VIII's insistence that, like, the Pope is superior to the emperor. He's like, no, I believe in the secular governing and, like, the church doing other things, you know, for example. So to put him into church is really funny, but I bet he would have fucking loved it.
Oh, yeah. Mm. Sure.
You know?
He's such a... His ego, is he, like, they say it a lot, his ego knows no bound. Mm-hmm. Like, it doesn't, because, like, this... But it's also, like, he's so good at what he does that it kind of doesn't matter that he has that inflated ego, because when you read through the Divine Comedy, when you read through all of this and you see this elaborate lore that he has glommed together from 24 different sources, you know, like myths and legends and stories about the Bible and, you know, apocryphal shit and all that, and he's just thrown it all together into this huge melting pot and mix, and he creates genres of literature, or at least is like the first one that we can find of stuff like body horror writing. Mm-hmm. And as you said, there are fantasy like medievalist fantasy elements in the story, especially in the Inferno. And he does that and you're like, God, this guy's a genius. And then 10 seconds later, he goes, God, I'm a fucking genius. And you're like,
spoil it.
Why? Like, why do you have to keep bringing it up? Like, what is wrong? Just have this much humility, just a little, just a smidge. And he's like, and you're like, God, this is so brilliant. Reading the like Forest of Suicides in the Inferno is just this heartbreaking, awful thing that makes you feel so awful for all of these people and everyone who's ever committed suicide and all this stuff. And then like 10 seconds later, Virgil's like patting him on the back. He's like, you know what, Dante, you're just, not only are you the smartest guy I've ever met, you're the best writer too. And you're so brave and strong. You're such a good boy. And you're just like, why are you like this?
Well, could I maybe introduce another type of post-it into the equation?
Please.
He's a fanfic writer.
Yeah.
Oh yes.
Oh God.
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. I mean, the first to ever do it, and probably the best to ever do it.
Best to ever do it. Yeah. Who has come close to Dante on the fanfiction front?
Like people like, I've literally had people directly roll their eyes at me when I call it fanfic, and I'm like, I don't mean it as an insult to him. No. Literally do think he is a genius of the written form, like pure, like, you know, let's just stop it right there. I do. But like, this is fanfic. That is what this is. Mm-hmm. It is him inserting himself into a religious scenario wherein he is the protagonist, and one of his great, probably his greatest hero, Virgil, is helping him along the way, patting him on the back and telling him how great he is. And then once they get out of purgatory, he then gets to meet up with Beatrice, his beloved, or whatever we want to call that weird relationship. And he meets up with her and she's like, I'm going to take you through this. We're going to bestow all these blessings upon you. You're the only person who gets to do this, blah, blah, blah. And he just gets to write like how he sees hell in his mind and from other stuff. And he's pulling stories, you know, he's pulling like from French stories, like Renaud the Fox. He's pulling from, you know, stories, you know, Judaic apocrypha and things like that. And he's, you know, even there are some Muslims in there and stuff like that, pagans, all this sort of pagan junk in there. And he just gloms it all together and makes it a part of like a wider Christian theological framework. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And it works. And that's the thing. Like the reason that we keep coming back to him is because it does work, because he is so good at this. And when you look at it, you're like, God damn it, he really is a great writer. Like, mm-hmm. He really did call his shot on this, that fucking asshole. And he does it. And you're just like, mm-hmm. I can't combat that. Like, there, it's definitionally fanfic. It feels like fanfic. Mm-hmm. It's just that it's been around for 800 years or 700 years. So it doesn't get called fanfic anymore. It's either called myth or legend or part of the Catholic dogma, kind of.
I mean, like almost anymore. Yeah. And I think that also it is fundamentally anyone who would argue that it isn't fanfic, they're just doing that from a place of snobbery. Yeah. You know, they're just saying that they're just attempting to denigrate fanfic, which, you know, feel free. Like, I'm not mad about it. Like, whatever, mm-hmm. you know, enjoy yourself. A lot of it needs to be denigrated or whatever. But fundamentally, that is what this is. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like the stories you would write when you were in year three.
Mm-hmm.
You know, where you'd be like, and there's a hobbit.
He's a little collector.
Yeah,
I was around, and he loves
little guys. He fucking loves weird little guys.
He's a little jackdaw guy. He sees different shiny things, and he picks them up and he builds them into this wonderful nest.
I have a final type of poster he is, though.
Okay, let's hear it.
So he's also the type of poster where he's just so mad horny, so mad horny, just horny on seven, like fucking the horny's all the way up, just like horny posting. And then you find out through back channels he's got a wife, and you're like, what the?
Yeah.
A wife that he never mentions writing. His wife's name is never mentioned once. But Beatrice, the girl that when he was
nine,
was like eight, and they met, and he was like smitten by her beauty then. And it just grew into his head, into this thing where he is like, she's the most beautiful woman ever. Like, she's my muse. She's the greatest thing that ever happened, you know, and he's telling himself all of this. And this is a woman he met once. He, by his own admission, didn't know that well and built up in his head. And after that, they saw each other like two or three times before she died in, I think, her 20s or something like that. And she is in 80% of the stuff he writes and is a huge fucking character in the Divine Comedy. And it's just like, what? Like, okay, man. I don't even know what to fucking say to that. I mean, and he and his wife had three kids, so it's not like he just hated her and threw her out, but like, I don't know what the fuck to say about that.
I know, like,
it's Dante's wife on Our Relationships.
Yeah, like,
oh, my bitch wife. She gets mad because I call her Beatrice when we fuck. What's her problem?
My F18 husband, also M18. It's just like, it's constantly in this girl Beatrice's mentions. Is something that I should be worried about?
Mm-hmm.
Should I say that it bothers me? Like, I've seen him sending fire emojis to Beatrice.
He's faving all her selfies. He's subscribed to her OnlyFans.
Why is he faving all her selfies?
Mm-hmm.
And then it's sort of split halfway between kind of calling her kind of controlling and paranoid, and then other people being like, this is no good.
Seems bad.
He's even writing about her on his blog, and she's like,
So yeah, it's this kind of sort of faux concern message saying, saw that Dante's writing about Beatrice in his blog again. You okay?
Right?
You okay, babe?
And then it's like, and he's like, well, you know, babe, it's just, I wouldn't want to expose our family life, you know, to the followers like that. You know, what we have is special and sacred. I couldn't possibly, you know, exploit our relationship for content. I would never do that.
Oh, that's it, isn't it? Yeah, okay, fine. Okay, so he's a horny, but I think that horny posting and fanfic writer are they're very much two horns on the same goat.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I will say one thing about him and Beatrice is, like, Dante is a convicted Catholic. Like, he believes all this stuff. He believes in heaven. It's very obvious that he believes in heaven, purgatory, and hell, and he's trying to make sense of it. But he puts Beatrice on the level of the Mother of Christ. Like, she is like, it, like in the Inferno, it's like it's like the Virgin Mary comes to Beatrice, is like, hey, you've got to go down, you've got to help Dante, you know this guy. And then by the end, she's like sitting at the table with like the Virgin Mary and God, like the top of the pillars of heaven, the Empyrean. You're like, what the fuck are you doing? Like, it's way beyond just like normal stuff. He's so sprung on this woman. It's insane.
It's like, you know, if you do that, if you could invite any three people to dinner, who would it be? And he's so horny for her that he's like God, the Virgin Mary, and Beatrice.
I think it would be God, Virgil, and Beatrice. I don't think
Virgil. Oh, I'd have to say God, Virgil, and Beatrice, you know. And then again, wife's on Reddit. He said God, Virgil, and Beatrice, Jay.
This is a throwaway because wife knows my handle.
I gotta get on my alt, baby. Don't worry about it. Don't worry about it. Don't worry about why. No.
We're running so close to time. I do have two more questions, and I think we are going to have to wrap up. The first one is something which is, I think, again important in terms of its distribution and in terms of how the Commedia functions as a giant post, and that is that it's not in Latin. The written language at the time was absolutely Latin, particularly for somebody of Dante's kind of background and education. But he wrote it in vernacular Italian, which was another sort of huge innovation, and it also was another thing which sort of caused this kind of this change in European literature, and the assumption that things don't have to be necessarily in an ancient language. It can be these ancient themes and looking back to the past and looking back for the cultural and artistic and historical legitimization of the past, but you can root it very squarely in the present, and you can make it so that the people around you can read it. And that's obviously that's super important. The language of the Commedia is really, really important. But my question is how many people actually were able to read it, would you say?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Like, that is, it's interesting because it's kind of vanishingly small still, because even if you are able to read not Latin, like, it's most people, if they can read and write, they write Latin, right? Like, so it's actually almost being more exclusive in a way, because like doing Latin opens you up to a larger audience in some ways. Although, having said that, who you're going to hit, interestingly, is the ladies. With this is because often the ladies will be literate in their own vernacular languages, so, you know, because if you're sending like letters back and forth, you're not necessarily going to be doing them in Latin. Some people do, but not everybody, and so this kind of opens up a larger readership along gender lines. For men, it's most men who can read, they can read and write Latin, right? Because by the time you can read, you've had somebody giving you an education, right? Mm-hmm. Like, someone sat you down and was like, here's your ABCs, right? This is what we're doing. And then by the time they're doing that, they do Latin for you. But it does open things up for more ordinary ladies. And also, it's an interesting one because it is doing something kind of highfalutin with vernacular language, because I mean, we will see vernacular texts like, I don't know, the Roman de Rose, the Pearl Poem, various romantic things will be written in the vernacular. So you'll get courtly love literature written in the vernacular, but it's usually in forms of French. Mm-hmm. It's not usually in terms of Italian. And then oftentimes when we get vernacular things that survive to us, it'll be like Chaucer or like, plays where all of the jokes are about farts. Yeah, because that's what ordinary people want. They want poop jokes. And so this is kind of like doing two interesting things. Like, one, we're doing it in vernacular, and two, it's kind of highfalutin at the same time. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It is interesting that it wasn't, or we don't have a surviving copy or note about it. It wasn't translated into Latin until over 100 years after his death, at least according to the records we have. So I find the fact that he wrote it in such a comparatively small language that only a small subset of people on the Italian peninsula could read, and it became so popular and so widespread and so beloved by people, even though for 100 years it was, I don't know, maybe 20,000 people could read it. You know, maybe however many, you know, are there. It's just like, yeah, it's, you know, it's wild to me that it did end up gaining this popularity because like, you know, when in the 15th century, when it gets translated and everything and the church kind of starts picking it up, that's when you get everything around it.
And it is an interesting point that you make there, Luke, because yeah, I think that it is important to note that, you know, he's writing this in Florentine. You know, like there's no such thing as Italian. So it's sure, like, yeah. You know, you're bang on. And I think that that is a really important thing to show, right? Because it's like, it was this popular even in, as you say, a tiny minority language, right?
I think it goes a long way. Like, you know, for all the, you know, all of the other legacy that it has and everything like that, I think it goes a long way to like showing how good, it's a slice of life into the medieval mind. And I think it shows a lot of that, especially that people were just like, all right, well, I'm going to at least kind of figure this out, you know, so I can read it. And it had become popular enough that they were like, all right, fine. We got to put it in Latin, I guess.
I would so love to talk a bit about its manuscript tradition and its mechanisms of distribution after his death and how it became so incredibly popular and so widely read. We unfortunately don't have time. I also wanted to talk about who his biggest beefs were, but I think actually the problem is that this episode is a 2-hour episode and we had an hour to talk about it. But it would be really, really great if at some point you two could return to talk some more about Dante.
We would love to absolutely do that.
We can slot that in with a Galileo episode. We could do a double header at some point in the future. But that is going to have to be all for today. And it remains only for me to thank Eleanor and Luke so much for coming on to talk to me about this.
Thanks so much for having us. And yeah, if you want more of this bullshit, we are over at We're Not So Different doing this. We actually have, for our patrons, we did an entire series on the Inferno where we broke it down chapter by chapter and did all the historical allusions. That's how much we love Dante. So.
endlessly fascinating work to me as someone who is not a specialist in the field, but, you know, has a particular interest in it. But yeah, check it out. I think we did 7 episodes on our Patreon. Patreon.com/WNSDpod. Phoebe, thank you so much for having us on. I really appreciate it.
An absolute pleasure. I was going to ask if you had anything to plug or say.
Oh, we'll plug ourselves.
I'll say where you say where you guys could be found. You already did that for me. That's fine. Again, we are dealing with pros. The links for We're Not So Different are going to be in the show notes. So do check that out. It's one of my favorite shows, and I'm not just saying that because I'm friends with them. It's good. I honestly have enough friends who have podcasts. I can't listen to them all, and I genuinely do listen to this one. So use that as your recommendation. This show is also supported by Patreon. We have all of our bonus material up there. That's patreon.com/10kpostpodcast. It enables us to keep the show editorially independent. It enables us to keep making it. And we are extremely grateful for everyone who supports it. This show is produced by Devon, which is Devon_on Earth. You can find them in all the usual places. You know who Devon is. You know who Devon is.
It's weird if you don't know who Devon is, bro.
It's weird at this point if I had to even introduce Eleanor to you, to be honest with you. You know who all these people are. Subscribe to my Substack. Listen to our other shows. And also there will be links to Medical Aid for Palestinians and other causes in the show notes below. But otherwise, thank you very much for listening. Catch you next time and have a good one. Bye.
Bye.